is Ralph Kermit Winterode with the Ralph Winterode Show, coming to you live out of Alaska. And it is a beautiful 59 degrees today, clear skies, and beautiful day outside, real light breeze, mosquitoes. I haven't seen one of them for a long time where I live here, so we're doing good. And want to try to get the two guests on. I've got two guests. I'm very honored that both of them would come on today. I have Dr. Judy Wood, which has written the book, Where Did the Towers Go? And she's a physicist, has a PhD, she's in civil engineering, mechanics, structural engineering. Dr. Judy Wood, are you there?
Yes, hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and I have a second guest I'm very honored to have also, Andrew Johnson, clear across the ocean over there in the UK. He's a software engineer, amongst many other things. Are you there, Andrew?
I'm here, Ralph. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, and we're going to talk about several things. One, of course, is the International Toronto hearings that they're conducting on September the 11th in Toronto, Canada. Now, of course, it's going to be really interesting. I've had two conversations, one with both people. One of them we're going to be playing right after the break here. I think we have enough time. It's a four-minute thing. We're going to play that, and then we're going to talk about Toronto and Dr. Judy Wood's book about the only comprehensive forensic investigation out there, and her new book, by the way, before we go to break, because we don't really have much time to get started, it can be found at www.wheredidthetowersgo.com, and you can purchase the book there. Andrew has a homepage. It's about check the evidence. I don't know the exact thing I was going to pull. Andrew, give us your webpage for checktheevidence.com?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of other interesting things on his homepage. Now, of course, the last thing we ever want to do with 911 or anything is check the evidence, because it takes away all of the nonsense that's going on in the world out there today. And I talked directly to James Gourley. That is the attorney, that his name is at the top of the list, so I presume he's the number one guy in charge. I talked to a Graham McQueen. I don't have his recording. I have it, but I didn't get it edited. But Dr. Judy Wood has not been invited to the international hearing on 911 in Toronto, Canada. Now, if you go over to that home page, I'll look it up here in just a second when I get back here. We go to break. It's absolutely astounding that the only comprehensive forensic investigation out there is hers, and she's not invited. Back in a minute. Well, we're back from break, and I have Dr. Judy Wood back east, and I have Andrew Johnson from the UK. And let's go ahead and start with the international hearing on 911 that's going to be in Toronto, James Gourley. Let's see what the conversation that I had. It's about a four-minute clip. Let's go ahead and play it.
Hello, this is James.
Yes. Hi, this is Ralph Winterode. I'm calling from Alaska.
Hi.
And I saw your thing here, the International Center for 911 Studies. You're having a thing in Toronto.
Yes.
And I was looking over the list of guests that you're having. And the first thing that struck me here are several of these people, of course, are not really qualified to analyze what happened. And I noticed that Dr. Judy Wood wasn't listed. Has she been invited to this? Or?
No, she's not.
I've read her book, checked it out. Is there any specific reason why you wouldn't invite her to the meeting?
The steering committee decided not to do it.
And who is the steering committee, I guess, then?
The steering committee is on the web. It's listed on the website.
So they don't want that. They don't want her there. They don't want her present.
Right.
Is there any particular reason? I mean, from what I read here, you're the one that's basically kind of behind this whole thing. Is there any specific reason why she wouldn't be invited?
She has absolutely wrong on virtually every point that she raises.
What points are those? I'd really be interested to know what your position is on
that. I wrote a paper about it, which is published at the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which you can go read. And you can also go read Dr. Greg Jenkins' paper about it, which he has never answered, either one of them. So,
have you read the book?
I haven't read the specific book, but I've read all of her writings that she used to compile the book.
But you haven't read the book?
No, I mean, I've heard that it contains the exact same claims that she's been putting forth previously, so I did not waste my time.
Okay, so what do you think happened then? I guess I guess you're pushing something, or you must think something happened there. So why? Because I like to say I read her book about the I don't find any evidence. So if you haven't read the book, of course we can't talk about that. So then what do you think happened?
I don't know. I don't think you do either.
Oh, I think I have a very good idea, but like I say, when you're calling for a new investigation, who are you calling to do this new investigation? Who do you think you're going to get to reopen 911 again?
Hopefully someone with subpoena power.
Well, that's only going to be Congress. They're not going to touch this again.
It could be a local government somewhere. You never know.
Are you not aware that the NIST report has been discredited? They discredited it themselves. That's one of the things you say you're...
Well, of course. Obviously.
Right. So you're going to talk about a discredited NIST report then, of where they...
That will be one aspect of it.
Well, that's very, very puzzling to me. Is Richard Gage going to be invited? I don't see his name on here.
Yes.
What is your degree? Do you have a degree in anything in physics or structural engineering or anything?
I have a degree in chemical engineering.
Well, boy, I am really puzzled because, like Niels Herrett, I read his... affidavit that was filed in Gallup's case, and I actually sent back to the attorney. He will not commit that thermite or nanothermite or thermate or whatever they want to call it is an explosive. That's what Richard Gage is using.
This is a waste of time. She's not coming, so do you have anything else?
Well, no, I just want to know why, because she's the only one.
Okay, I mean, I've already told you. Her theories are nonsense.
Yeah, okay, well, I guess.
Okay, all right. See you.
Well, either one of you want to jump in?
I'll start out. I don't have any theories. I present evidence. And I've not ever presented evidence. He talked about the debunked. Whatever, he debunked ray beams from space. I've never presented any evidence claiming that, the towers were destroyed by laser beams from space or whatnot. So he apparently is not familiar with my writings.
Okay. James Gourley is known to me. When I first made some postings about Dr. Judy Wood's research, he replied that he'd written this paper published in this Journal of 9/11 Studies, which supposedly debunked these quote-unquote claims. But, of course, James Gourley has not debunked anything. And in that conversation, he referred to an interview with Dr. Greg Jenkins, which is typically what is posted around the Internet when Dr. Wood's research comes up as a subject, as if this is some kind of proof that this is invalidates what the research shows. And, of course, it does no such thing. And James Gourley claimed in that conversation that Dr. Judy Wood has never replied to the Jenkins sort of points or these points that Gourley had made in his paper. This, of course, is not true. If you go onto the Critics' Corner section, you'll find the articles posted there which essentially go through some of those points. And we'll show you, basically what they're up to, which is the same as what a lot of other people are up to, which is covering up, ignoring, misquoting, muddling up the actual evidence that has been put on the table. And that's the name of the game. And we've seen that continue with that conversation with James Gourley. He's been doing it. He's been at it now for about 4 years, I think. And he has not yet... And then he makes this ridiculous statement in that phone call where he says, I haven't read the book, but I've read all her writings, which she used to make up the book. I mean, how can he possibly have done that? Did he have access to the manuscript? before it was published. This is obviously a lie. He can't be telling the truth because not everything that's in the book is on the website.
Right. The website contains a bunch of pictures, you know, in the, you know, kind of topic area, but it's not, I'm not publishing my book on my website. I've just used it as a filing cabinet while I'm working on the book because you've heard the term, dead people keep secrets. Well, I didn't want to be one of those, so I wasn't going to keep secrets. So I used it as a filing cabinet, put the pictures out there. So if something happened to me, people would at least, you know, say, what's this? And so, you know, then I carefully put together the book. But while I was working the book, I needed sort of a life insurance policy. And that's what the website was. The website is not the same as my book.
Absolutely not, because I've read the book and I've looked at your webpage.
No, the website's just a filing cabinet.
That's right. I mean, you've compiled all this in a succinct, basically laying out all the evidence in your book, chapter by chapter, addressing each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's what it's about. So there's that sort of procedure which you can use to make a case that what you're saying is true, which, of course, is the sort of basis that you would need to start a legal case of some kind. You know, move that forward. And these hearings, I mean, you know, I've made a posting about this summarizing some of the, you know, sort of people that are in these hearings or some of the things they've already said, which I think we can use as a guide to actually, you know, guessing what's going to come out at these hearings, which is basically not a lot. And if people go to that, you know, to my website, checktheevidence.com, and look on the right-hand side and scroll down, and you'll see recent postings, and the article I've called it 9/11 Truth Deafness in the Toronto Hearings. You know, it's kind of a sort of little pun, I suppose you could call it, a very good one, but I think appropriate.
What I find you know, quite interesting is anyone who's read my book has a good idea of what happened. They don't know the serial number, but they know what the technology does. They know what destroyed the towers. What type of technology? My book is just nothing but evidence. There's no speculation in there. It's just evidence. Evidence that can lead to various conclusions. I don't conclude anything beyond what the evidence says, what the evidence can support. So if this needs to be covered up, how would someone go about covering that up? So they claim that's not the evidence you should look at. We need to drum up evidence and publish it in a book that doesn't include Dr. Wood's work, and then issue that as saying, this is the only evidence you should look at.
Right.
That's what seems to be happening.
Well, what I find strange is, on the NIST report, where were all these folks?
Yeah.
I submitted a federal, first I submitted a request for corrections to NIST. So calling them on it, that, you know, that something's not right with the report. And also, you know, there's a conflict of interest with your contractors who are developers and manufacturers of energy weapons. The Architects and Engineers group suddenly popped up about three and a half weeks later. And that's when Richard Gage's website first went up, which is kind of interesting. And then after that, a week or two after that is when I submitted my federal QTEM case that is sort of folks in Richard Gage's group, I understand, are forbidden from talking about it. They didn't want people to know about it, and they definitely don't support it. So if they did support my federal case that had a little bit allowed to go forward, we could have put people under oath. Isn't that what they want? Isn't that what the Toronto people are wanting to do? So why didn't they support it?
Who are those people? Two of them. Oh,
really?
Got to go to hold that. We'll be back in just a minute. Got to go to break. Be back in just a minute to find out a couple of names of companies that have information that can figure out who done it. Dr. Jenny Wood, what are the name of two of these companies that you actually filed a QTEM case on? that were involved in the misinformation and cover-up in 911.
Well, what I point out is that they are, you know, guilty of science fraud. They know better than what they put forward. They signed off on a report that they know is fraudulent, and that's fraud. Applied Research Associates, ARA, they're, one of their primary areas is that they develop and manufacture energy weapons. They also, I believe, still have a government contract in addition to know everything about any weapon of mass destruction that exists or is being developed. So put those two things together. They can identify the effects, or they also do a lot of lethality testing to see what different weapons do. So they not only know, could recognize what weapon was used, but it's a pretty good chance they would know whose weapon it was that was used. The other, some other ones are SAIC, that's Science Application International Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
One of their, you know, they also do energy weapons, but they're also involved in PSYOPs. It's interesting, they're involved in preparing the, helping NIST prepare the report.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
Underwriters Lab, that tested the steel. Well, they made a full scale mock-up, two full scale mock-ups, two half scale mock-ups, and they set them on fire of the floor of the WTC. They set them on fire to see what would happen, and they burned, let them burn for like twice as long as the actual fires took place in the World Trade Center towers. But they also had it like at twice the temperature in Fahrenheit, you know, much higher temperature for much longer, and 4 out of 4 times, it never failed to support load. In other words, the floor span did not fail due to fire. They could not get it to fail due to fire, even at twice the temperature for twice as long. Yet they signed off the report saying the fire did it. That's fraud.
That's absolute fraud. Absolutely.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, so this is a case in point. You can see that vested interests are being protected, and we have this connection directly, if you pardon the pun, to the energy question, and also the psychological operations, which, of course, you know, I would certainly argue, and I think Dr. Wood would probably agree, that these Toronto hearings are essentially just that. They are a psychological operation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're intended to create a certain perception among a certain group of people, and that perception is not one which will include the very powerful and very convincing evidence that Dr. Wood has mentioned in brief, you know, so far in this program, and has put into the book, etc. So I think, you know, that SAIC must be one of the key sort of linchpins in this whole deal, really, to me, you know, from what I've read, and I'd already come across them myself. When I first came across them was in 2003 in other stuff that I was reading, which was to do with basically with black programs. So again, it's looking like this is a very, very significant thing to be thinking about.
Well, when I talked to Graham McQueen, and even this, they know that the NIST report is total nonsense. They've admitted it. So now they're going to have a hearing on this. Now, Dr. Wood, let me read this and see if you can tell me. This is a letter you got from NIST dated July 27, 2007. It says, as stated in NCSTAR1, NIST, N-I-S-T, only investigated the factors leading to the initiations of the collapse of the WTC towers, not the collapses themselves, end quote. Your comment?
Yeah, they admitted to me that their report was a fraud. So it's already been done. You know, it says it in the report, but it was a little bit ambiguous, and here they said it very clearly. This is clearly stated. And yeah. So it's no question, this fraud.
Yeah, I read it in the report. It's in the footnotes all over. I searched out every place. So why would you have an international hearing on 911 on a report that says we didn't even look beyond when the, quote, clap started?
Right.
What am I guessing here?
And, they don't want to discuss the evidence either.
But how could they discuss the evidence if they didn't even go beyond, it says here, the initiation of the collapse? Well, they didn't even investigate. They just looked at the, quote, planes and the collapses themselves. They admit, we didn't look at the evidence.
I just received an email talking about the, there's a new evidence, proof, absolute proof that the NIST report is wrong. is this like bell lap? Ding, ding, ding. I mean, round and round we go.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a report that didn't even admit they didn't look at the evidence, and it's been discredited by the people that was, some of the people that's on the committee, why would you spend more than about 2 or 3 minutes trying to discredit it?
PSYOPs.
Hold on, America. Get your answer when we come back. Okay, we're back from break here, and Dr. Judy Wood, do you want to continue on with what you were stating there?
What was my... what the purpose is of the Toronto thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, too many people are starting to read my book and see that there's evidence, this clear evidence that describes what happened if somebody just looks at it. So they can't refute my book. That would also draw too much attention to it. Nobody has, or they would have, refuted it. And what they can refute a made-up story, you know, a straw man that they do, but they can't refute the book. So how do they keep people from looking at it? Oh, don't look there. Look over here. Look over here. You know, see what we have here.
Right. That's it. And I think, you know, one of the key points that I put in the article, and I'm pretty sure either myself or Dr. Wood or both of us have discussed this before, going back to this point that was made a few minutes ago that the Architects and Engineers Group seemed to sort of come into being just around the time that Dr. Wood submitted her, you know, the RFC, the request for correction, came into being, and Richard Gage was starting to sort of become one of these speakers. And that group, which included James Gourley, by the way, Steve Nee Jones, Richard Gage, and there was a couple of other guys, I think, named on this, Bob McElvain was one, they also submitted a request for correction 3 weeks after Dr. Wood. But yet, if you go and look at that document, you can download it from NIST's own website because they've got to put those documents on the public record. You will find the word thermite only in one place, and it's in the middle of a URL, which is a reference to Steve Nee Jones's paper. And if you click that URL and go to Steve Nee Jones's paper, you will find the very first thing in that paper is a disclaimer, which says that this scientific paper represents the views of the author. It's the only supposed scientific paper that I've seen with a disclaimer in it. So, you know, if these people who are, if James Gourley is meant to be setting up these hearings in Toronto or assisting with them, what sort of pedigree do they have if he is talking about, you know, this supposedly conclusive hard evidence, and then they're not actually putting that in the legal foundation for a challenge? What sort of basis to move forward into any kind of honest inquiry is that? I would suggest that it's no basis at all, because it fundamentally represents a point of dishonesty, which was the same as what was made in Gourley's telephone call, where he claimed to have read everything that Judy would have written, which wasn't even possible, because everything that she had written before the book came out was not even publicly available.
Well, when I talked to Graham McQueen, which is the other gentleman up there, I asked him about what their goals were, and they wanted to make the public aware of especially the NIST report and the government report. And I said, well, what is your premier, what's the number one guy for evidence? Well, who? Is there somebody there that's going to present some evidence? Niels Harrit. Now, that's the name that he come up with. Now, I have a copy of, it was out of the Second Circuit here, on Gallup. It was a lady that was at the Pentagon, and an attorney filed in because they're going to get sanctioned because they're off on La La Land. And this is an affidavit. This is two excerpts of an affidavit from Niels Herit. Now, here's the first one here. It says, we published a report of our findings in March 2009 in the Open Chemical Physics Journal. A copy of this report is attached to this affidavit as Exhibit B. We have noted that ordinary thermite acts as an incendiary when ignited. However, when ingredients are ultra fine, are intimately mixed, the mixture reacts very rapidly, even explosively. There is a highly energetic form of thermite known as energetic nanocomposite super thermite. Now you go on down to another place where he addressed this. Now he won't stick his neck out about what's really going on. And the other one here is, this is, with that said, however, we explained in the report under the heading, can super thermite be handled safely? Thus, the energetic nanocomposite can be sprayed or even painted onto surfaces, effectively forming an energetic or even explosive paint, end quote.
Here's something about thermite that acts really quickly, and if it's on the surface, the deal with thermite is it needs to melt steel, and that's done through thermal conductivity. So if you have a nano layer of thermite on the surface and it acts really quickly, what do? You just melted the top layer and it's gone. You're left with the rest of the structure. You know, it's like paint stripping.
This is like Alice in Wonderland.
There's another interview where he stated, this is the exact transcript. Actually, within the group, this is talking about their nanothermite paper, within the group, the authors behind the paper, which we published in April, there are diverting opinions about what the nanothermite was used for. And in my opinion, we should not speculate for the demolition.
Well, you know, I'm just, I went to the witness list here. We have Mike Greville. He's a U.S. senator, a presidential candidate in 2008. Now, he's really going to be interested. He's got a lot of expertise. Cynthia McKinley. She's a former U.S. congressman and a member of the Green Party. That's really going to help a whole hell of a lot, pardon my French. We got Lance de Havilland Dye Smith, professor, and he's a school here for public administration policy at the Florida State University. Political science and philosophy, that's a lot of technical expertise there. We have Peter Dale Scott, the Canadian, and he's a former English professor and a diplomat and a poet. And he's known for his criticism of U.S. foreign policy, so dating back to the Vietnam War, I wish him well. David Ray Griffith, retired professor of philosophy and religion and theology. I'm going to say a prayer on this one. And we have Michelle Chaka. You want to pronounce that for me again, Andrew?
Chosudovsky. Chosudovsky is the name.
Chosudovsky, right. And he's economics at the University of Ottawa, so we got somebody with economics there, and he is an economic advisor to governments in developing countries. Then we have Paul Zaremka or something.
Zaremka, yeah, I know of him, yeah.
Okay, well, he's International Labor Organization. He's out of Geneva, Switzerland, and that's really on economy and stuff. That's really going to help a whole bunch. And Jonathan Cole says here, 10 years head of a mid-sized engineering firm with 25, and he's tied into Richard Gage. Now we have David Chandler. Wonder what his qualifications. He's a high school physics teacher, I guess, right?
Not sure.
Yeah, and he has mathematics. So that's the biggest thing they got. We have Laurie Manuel, PhD candidate in behavioral neuroscience and toxicology.
Toxicology.
That's really helpful for drugs on learning, memory, behavior, information processing, self-esteem, emotion. I'm getting pretty emotional here. And then we got Niels Herit. And we have Richard Gage, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And then we have Graham McQueen, who I talked to, and he's got a comparative religion from Harvard University, and he taught religious studies. Well, we're going to need a lot of praying on this if we ever get to the truth. And Kevin Ryan, and that's it.
It's my understanding Kevin Ryan worked for Underwriters Lab, doing wastewater testing. He's a chemist, so he tests, I don't know, sewage treatment plants. He tests water quality, something to do with water testing.
Mm-hmm. So we have two left, Niels Herit and Richard Gates. That's the two premier people. Anybody want to comment about their great expertise? And
I think you've just got to look at what these people have said, what they've put on the record, and it is deeply troubling. As you pointed out with the affidavit is not really particularly specific. It's couched in very vague terms, like he's not willing to commit himself to, for example, cross-examination. And then we go back to the original RFC. I think Niels Herit also contributed to that as well in 2007. I could be mistaken. I have to double-check. But certainly this whole talk of thermite as being some type of evidence is ridiculous, as we've almost beaten this one to death. But, again, for those that haven't heard this before, thermite doesn't turn things to dust. It essentially melts through them. And you also need a very hot fuse to get it going. It's not something you can easily get going. And when you looked at the destruction of the towers, did they come down with a whole huge, sort of pyrotechnical display? No, they didn't. They turned to dust. We had a little bit of fire where these supposed planes hit, which were real planes. That's another story. Then we had them turning to dust. So, whatever spin you put on thermite, I was saying to somebody today, you can put it in a vanity journal, such as in the Open Chemical Physics Journal, where you have to pay $800 to get it published. You can put it on blogs, you can put it on wherever you like. It is still not going to explain what happened to the World Trade Center.
Yeah, they say, well, thermite was used on 9/11. Okay, what was it used for? If you know it was used, you would know what it was used for. But one thing I would like to point out is, one thing that's very well established, the towers turned to dust in midair. They didn't burn up, nor did they slam to the ground. They turned to dust in midair. We don't have a seismic signal that corresponds with a 500,000-ton building hitting the ground. And if a 500,000-ton building slammed to the ground, it would have busted the bathtub, the dike that goes around the World Trade Center, which was really built in the Hudson River. Manhattan would have been flooded if stuff slammed to the ground. Plus, we had all this dust all over the place, and there wasn't a pile of debris left. So if you blow up the building with bombs, you get chunks go flying and they slam to the ground. Didn't happen. If you slice and dice the building up with, thermite, quote, cutter charges, however you imagine being able to slice into columns, they make this big deal about 30-foot segments. Well, you'd still have 500,000-ton buildings slamming to the ground. Didn't happen. So what was it used for? Turns out if the building turned to dust, which it did, let's see what would be in the dust. Building is a steel structure with aluminum cladding. So if the building turned to dust, you'd have tiny, nano-sized particles of aluminum and nano-sized particles of steel. Well, if it was molecular dissociation, the steel has come apart. But pure iron, maybe in steel, 99%, at least over 97% for structural steel. So if you have all this, iron, small bits of iron, the smaller it is, the more surface area to rust, and it would be instantly rusted. So we have, rusty iron in the dust and aluminum dust. Okay, let's see what we can do with those. Richard Gage, says that's some of the ingredients of thermite, so therefore thermite's there. How does he account for the missing building? How does he know that the specks of aluminum, the nano aluminum in the dust, and the nano iron, rusted iron in the dust? How does he know that is thermite? And what does thermite do? To me, it seems like it is a cover up to the fact that the building turned into dust in midair. So you have pulverized building in the dust.
Which you can prove, because when it gets to the bottom, when what does the TV people that were there, what was their names that tried to look at this video, says, where's the building?
Yeah, Peter Jennings in the studio is asking George Stephanopoulos at the scene, where's all the rubble? George says, Well, I'm trying to figure that out, and I asked a volunteer, and they said it all fell down to the ground, was pulverized and evaporated.
Yeah, they got a video camera shooting across where the rubble should be, right?
Right, and the building's gone. And there's dust all over the place.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth pointing out that if you listen to Richard Gage enough, if you can stand it, and if you listen to Niels Harriott, they will both say, in fact, I had an email from Niels Harriott. Somebody put me on one of these group lists. And in this email, Niels Harriott says the spire, which is this 70 stories of unsupported steel, turned to dust. Even he says that. Gage says it, if you listen to them. So they do agree that the building's turned to dust, and yet they come out with this ridiculous claim that thermite turns things to dust. And every video that you watch or every experiment you watch, you know, it doesn't do that.
No, the spire, they claimed they debunked my book by claiming that the spire just fell over, that it didn't turn to dust. They claimed that was just dust that was settled on the columns. These 700-foot tall, like, think of a broom handle, just, you know, balancing. So that had to be a strong column to be freestanding like that. But the building is being destroyed.
Mm.
The building is being destroyed, leaves these core columns, and then they turn to dust. Just before they turn to dust, you see crisp outlines of the steel. Very clear, distinct outlines, and you see blue sky in the background. You don't see a haze of suspended dust around it. So if it dust settled on it, it had to have settled there in approximately 2 or 3 seconds, and it had to, boom, like a magnet, you know, just suck right up to the steel column, which didn't happen. So because you have this dust, he said it settled on the vertical columns. Then if the thing fell and left this fine dust hanging in the air, how do you explain how that fine dust is hanging in the air when it settled on the columns in 2 seconds?
There isn't any explanation other than what you offered.
And if it fell straight down, there's videos from all different angles, like at least 3 different angles, and it doesn't tip over. Plus, if it tipped over, it'd take out a few city blocks. So is there a 700-foot hole for it to drop straight down into? Yeah, but you don't even need to decide if it fell over or not. The fact that you have fine dust hanging in the air that wasn't there before the columns went away, for whatever reason they went away. So the columns went away, and left behind is this fine dust hanging in the air.
To the columns that don't exist, because they couldn't exist, because otherwise...
Right.
Oh God, this is like a merry-go-round.
So this is intellectually dishonest for them to claim to have debunked my work based on that one picture. It's like, how well can they convince people that piece really isn't what people see it is? You know, why would they be doing that? And then there's, you know, hundreds of other pictures I have, and there's several of them in my book that show steel falling through the air and trailing this real thick, you've seen those images, I think plenty of them on TV. It looks like just opaque volumes of dust pouring out of the back of the piece of steel as they're falling towards the ground, but they never reach the ground, only dust all over everywhere.
Yeah, well, just like the top of the World Trade Center, you can see it tilting, and it's headed off. Hit something adjacent, but it never hits anything adjacent because by the time it gets to the ground, it's dust.
Right. You don't see a thud in the seismic chart either.
No, and there's no sound. We're going to get into some real evidence. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned. I think Dr. Judy Wood, I forgot what you were talking about. We were talking about something else. Remember what we were talking about?
Just the unscientific insanity out there. People say things over and over again as though it makes it true. And they get away from the science.
That's absolutely. And I think what we've got going on with this, you know, as I've been saying to people, I first heard this thermite story in the end of 2005, and I believed it because, you know, I didn't know then what I know now. And I thought this Stephen Jones character was credible. So, you know, I don't want to go on about that. But so the thermite story has been in existence since the end of 2005. So we're getting towards... In fact, it is just about 6 years. So we're at a greater distance of time now between when that story came out and when 9/11 happened, you know, and now, if you see what I mean. And we've got all these groups now mainly repeating that story. So we've essentially got most, you know, the vast majority of the alternative media has now fulfilled the same role as the mainstream media did in getting their first cover-up out there. The alternative media is now, even, you know, very recently in the last week, is doing a good job of promoting this Thermite story. You know, and you get this Gage frontman to do the job. And, it, you know, again, if you listen to him, he sounds credible. It's not until you actually start to sit down and pick it apart a bit more, you know, that you begin to see, you know, what the problems are. And I was talking to Dr. Wood earlier on today, and I was describing my experience of going to see some people at the local library. And, you know, I basically caught them, if you will, before they'd been exposed to this Thermite story too much. And they were, you know, it was very clear to them what I was showing them in terms of the evidence that I showed them. I had a PowerPoint and stuff. And it was much easier for them to see, you know, see the evidence, see what it meant, see that it was significant, because they hadn't been exposed to this psychological operation in the form of, you know, Steve Nee Jones and, you know, all those guys and the Architects and Engineers group. So it's very, very effective what they've done. It is a psychological operation. And the people, there are certain people, I think, probably Gage and Gourley are two of them, who are very, you know, have a very good knowledge of what they're up to. But I think a lot of the other people just get swept up in it all, into the self-importance of it. You know, and I think some of them find it very difficult to get out of that.
Especially they put them up on a pedestal and make them feel important, and then by that they control them. And I was even told that if I spoke about the Hutchison effect, I was history. I was told that we can't save you from what will happen to you. At first I thought it was a death threat, but I think it's in terms of throwing me overboard and then having them mow me down with a steamroller, figuratively.
Mm. Well, I just can't imagine, you know, if I had to get up and do what Richard Gage is doing, what has he got? He says he's got the elements, things that look like that are made out of thermite in the dust, and he has microspheres. That's it.
He claims that the only place you can get, you know, iron in the dust is through thermite. It's a byproduct of thermite that he totally neglects the point that the building was made out, is a steel structure with aluminum cladding. Over 100,000 tons of steel in each building, and steel being 97-98+% iron, you can have a lot of iron in the dust.
And it's not in the rubble, right?
Not in the rubble. And the seismic signal reflected a 16-20-story building crashing to the ground, not a 110-story building crashing to the ground.
Well, how can you get up and talk for? I give him the benefit of the doubt. I've wasted several hours listening to his stuff. Oh, well, we're going to break. We'll be back in a minute, and then we're going to get to the more on the real evidence of what's really going on. Thank you. Well, this is the Ralph Winterode Show with Ralph Winterode II, and I'm real honored to have Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson on today. And we have a guest here. We'll get take our caller, I mean. Dave and Idaho, why don't we go ahead before we get started in the next hour?
Yeah, I'll make this quick because your guests, Ralph, are at the best. What I see is that the fact that when you look at the aftermath pictures and you see what's left over and how it was dealt with, I just go back to the OKC bombing, and then you look at those helicopter pictures where you have about 25-30% of that building blow up, supposedly from a fertilizer bomb. Look at the aftermath pictures, and you see kind of the same thing. There's the building is torn away, and then where the building is torn away, it's just kind of like a cut mark, and there's a bunch of, like, let's say, spare metal sticking out. And then from there, everything left on the ground could not possibly, even the dust left out in the road, equal the actual mass of what was cut away from that building.
Exactly right. And I've got a picture of that on my website. I say, you know, it looks just like the middle of Building 6, which went missing. But can you tell which is which? Hint, one of them has weak checks at the bottom. That's the only way you can really tell them apart. But the OKC thing looked like, you know, cylindrical cutouts. And few people realized toasted cars were there, too.
What's even more amazing, too, is the videos is there was supposed to be the fertilizer bomb, and it supposedly did all this damage, and there's a fire truck sitting out there on a perfectly smooth pavement with no problems at all. So how did it blow the whole building away at a distance that is not possible to begin with, and it didn't even take the upper layer of oil off of the pavement underneath it? Total nonsense.
Well, and then take a radius, if you were to take a radius out of that building, which the building is more dense than the air around it across the street, the building across the street did not have the same damage. So it didn't basically take a radius damage problem and collapse the other buildings on the other side the same way.
Right, because it's an omnidirectional bomb if it actually happened. It's totally a total setup cover story, and they supposedly executed somebody for it. Now you go figure that one out.
Yep. Anyway. Thanks for the guest, Ralph. You guys have a good Sunday night.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks.
Yeah, do we have time to play that one clip we got here on the Gary Nall Show? Go ahead. Let's try it.
Well, it's no problem. That's
heat.
Not really the problem.
Okay, up to 3,000 degrees it takes to melt
what
iron. And tremendous heat. Up to 3,000 degrees it takes to melt iron, and they couldn't put out these fires, in fact, for months as a result, even though they're bathing them in a bathtub of water.
Anybody like to comment on that one?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That'd be good for Saturday Night Live. Go ahead.
Very much. I wonder how many people realize that Chernobyl was caused by a steam explosion. It wasn't caused by a nuclear, you know, explosion. The steam explosion tore the building open so the nuclear material could waft up into the open, you know, atmosphere.
Oh, my God, we need to expand on this. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we're back for a break here. And Dr. Judy Wood was just commenting on Richard Gage's molten metal in a bathtub or a pool of water in a bathtub. You want to go ahead and explain this to us, Dr. Wood?
Yeah, thermite, when it works by burning paper and melting aluminum, and it would have, you know, been so bright it would have blinded people. But there's no evidence of that, nor there's evidence of any high temperatures, because enormous amounts of water poured on the pile, the so-called pile, would have caused steam explosions if the water and the molten metal mixed. So talking about cooling molten metal with water is ridiculous. This is why water is not used for grease fires. The grease is well above the boiling point of water. When water turns into steam, it expands in volume by 1,600 times. So when water hits the hot grease, it would explode, spattering hot oil all over the place. The same thing would happen if you put water on a pool of molten metal. You'd be putting water on the same thing as putting it on a vat of hot oil. There would be enormous steam explosions on 9/11, and that didn't happen.
That's absolutely idiot. I mean, anybody would be familiar with, if you have a skillet, you definitely don't pour just water into it unless you want to just be
spattered.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. And this is Richard Gage talking.
And that's what happened at Chernobyl. Steam explosions. You know, you get a little bit of water getting into a hot place, and boom.
Well, I worked.
I think also what I was going to add to that was that, you know, we've talked about, or I've talked about, or we've probably both talked about this concept of muddling things up and confusing people deliberately. And you know, one of the pieces of evidence that Dr. Wood has put on her website and in the book is this, you know, the bathtub, which was what the World Trade Center was constructed inside to keep out the Hudson River. That was its kind of common name. There's probably a more technical, you know, engineering name for it, but it was called the bathtub to keep out the water. So when something like Gage is saying something so ridiculous, and, you know, associating that ridiculousness, if that's a word, with the bathtub, then when that comes up in another context, people are subconsciously already primed to think, oh, well, this is nonsense. This is to do with the nonsense that Richard Gase, you know, says, so I'm just going to skip over this bit. You know, and that's what's going on here. The whole, you know, movement around thermite is to discredit, you know, thorough investigation into the events, because anybody who really does know what they're talking about, any scientist, will see that the notion of using thermite to do what was done to the Dowers is patently ridiculous.
We've got two callers here. Let me take we'll take those callers real quick, and then we're going to get back into a summary. I'd like to talk about all of the real evidence instead of what these idiots out there are trying to cover up with. E.T. in New Mexico, you got a question for the guest?
Hi, Ralph. Hi, Dr. Judy Wood and Jeffrey, I think. I just have there's a saying that I think is apropos here. That truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently rejected. And third, it is accepted as self-evident. And it seems like this 9/11 thing is in probably the stage of being violently rejected.
I appreciate your thoughts, but there's another scenario. Look at what happened with the JFK incident. Folks knew that the Lee Harvey Oswald story was ridiculous. That was the official story. The grassy knoll became the official, unofficial story, where it didn't need to be proved true or false. It was where everybody ran to who knew that the first story was wrong. And what do we have with the thermite? We have the thermite knoll. If people know that the official story is wrong, it gives them someplace to run that'll never be proved or disproved.
Well, I thought that was interesting in talking to James Corley. Even he couldn't come up with a quote theory. And number two, he couldn't identify one thing to debunk your book. And here's a guy that's putting on the Toronto International hearings. And he says,
right.
And he knows about evidence. Well, hopefully he got through attorney school and didn't cheat.
I think to come back to the caller's point, you know, that is oft quoted, and I think there is some truth in it. You know, this is what is happening, but I think it's done against the backdrop of, as Dr. Wood was pointing out, this sort of, you know, this other truth, quote unquote, that's meant to be the truth, and most of the people in our experience have been herded into that. You know, as I was saying earlier on, here we are 5 years later, 6 years later now, after this thermite story came about. And then, of course, we've got the other things like the mini-nukes, and I've had quite a lot of email about Dmitry Karlazov, you know, and all these other ridiculous stories, which, you know, we have to spend time going through and explaining to people, you know, to just use their brain a bit and look at the evidence, look at what's here. And you know, work out for yourself that this doesn't explain what we've seen.
Well, while we're at it, maybe I can insert a quick one on that, on the same theme of the steam explosions. If you have bombs in the basement, bombs create lots of heat, especially nukes. If you rupture the bathtub by crashing the building down or by the bomb in the basement, you have the Hudson River mixing with real hot bomb. You have a steam explosion. That didn't happen.
Well, steam is very dangerous. I worked in a powerhouse as an electrician, and I saw it went through a Schedule 180 in the side of a boiler and took out about 6-8 feet in diameter, and it went through Schedule 80. That's just a steam, a little bit of poof of steam. Steam is extremely dangerous stuff. Oh, God, I can't believe it. And we're going to believe that there's molten metal sitting in the water down there.
Under a bathtub of water.
Yeah, right. Just dream on. CJ in Missouri, you have a question for the guest?
No, sir. I just wanted to make an observation. You had mentioned Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
I had an opportunity to speak with General Ben Parton for about 30 minutes on the phone. He'd been at the Pentagon for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, and he was an expert or is an expert in explosives. He told me point blank that it was impossible for a bomb in a truck to blow up the Oklahoma City building. He said that the building was set with explosives. He told me he's testified to that in the Senate. And it's my understanding that Clinton had been trying to pass an anti-terrorist bill, but to of no avail. After Oklahoma City, it was my understanding that it passed within 2 weeks.
Well, I watched the video of him. Yes, he was an expert, and they didn't want to hear about anything about that it wasn't what they said it was. They wanted the cover story.
That sounds familiar, kind of like this Toronto thing. They don't want to hear about anything but the story they want to put out there that doesn't work.
Right. Well, thanks for your call. And, you know, the bottom line is I have you may hear a little bit of whistling. You know, I have a front tooth here that come off, and I'm going to go to the dentist Tuesday. Now, I am not going to have a theologian there. I'm not going to have anybody from psychology. I'm sure the hell not going to have a congressman there. I don't want anything about medical insurance. I don't want an economist there. I want a dentist there. Now, the question becomes, of all of these people at Toronto that we listed and your qualifications, Dr. Judy Wood, how many people are actually qualified to actually look into a forensic investigation?
A forensics engineer with a PhD, it's like 35 years experience. I don't know. But this truth movement has been led to believe that a theologian is just as good.
There's only one person that's qualified to do to look into all this stuff, and you're the one person that hasn't been invited. Of all their witnesses, you stack them all up against you, and that's nothing.
And it isn't just that another engineer. The background I have is in forensic engineering and in materials analysis, materials characterization, also interferometry, interfering different energy fields.
And nobody has this. And Gage admits they're not qualified. So, and then Gorley says, well, who are we going to get it? Well, Congress, well, they're not going to do it. So we're going to have some other little teeny government, you know. Maybe the city of Wasilla can pull this off up here.
The lack of seismic signal, someone brought that up to Mr. Gage, and he responded saying he doesn't understand seismic signals, so therefore we need to ignore that evidence. He used different words, but that was the gist of it.
You know,
he doesn't understand it.
Why don't you take the time here to go through all of these things that they will not address and give us a rundown of the real empirical evidence that you've researched out and bring forward in your book?
Well, the buildings didn't burn up, nor did they crash down. They turned into dust in midair. How do we know this? Because the seismic signal does not reflect two 110-story buildings slamming to the ground, nor the 47-story Building 7 slamming to the ground, nor Building 3 slamming to the ground, et cetera. And all these buildings went missing that day, literally went missing, except there was dust in place of them. And also we know that they didn't slam to the ground because we'd see a pile of debris left. That was somewhat appropriate for the size of buildings that were destroyed. That didn't happen. And as we discussed, the towers were built in the Hudson River with the bathtub, you know, a dike, holding out the Hudson River because the bedrock that they're built on is 70 feet below the water table. If you crash something down on it, it's going to break the bathtub and flood lower Manhattan. And that didn't happen. But a couple of days after 9/11, they brought in earth-moving equipment to help with the cleanup. That did damage the bathtub, just moving, you know, heavy machinery around. Also, when they brought down the remains of Building 6, an 8-story building where like half the building's mass went away, they pulled it down with cables because they were afraid that if they used a stick of dynamite, it would damage the bathtub wall.
Okay, let's stop right there. Okay, we'll be back in just a minute. We're going to hear. We're hearing the real evidence now with an answer. Back in a minute. Okay, we're back from break here. I have Dr. Judy Wood, which I'm very honored to have, and I'm also honored to have Andrew Johnson out of the UK. And there's a book out, Where Did the Towers Go?, available at www.wheredidthetowersgo.com. And it's the only comprehensive forensic investigation of 911 in the public forum today. Dr. Judy Wood, go ahead. You were telling us real evidence. When I asked you a question, you didn't stutter at all. And I continue.
And this isn't a list of talking points I've memorized either. It's just one thing leads to the other. Okay, we have also have weird fires. You know, fire, what looks like fires, but it doesn't seem to melt plastic. You know, so it's not related to high heat. It's fires without heat. Also, the appearance of molten metal is liquid, but it's not hot. Or glowing pieces of metal. It's solid orange color, kind of looks like a Cheeto. I come up with a different vocabulary for things that are weird that we don't know. We don't have a previously known description of them, you know, phenomena to describe. And these are sitting on paper. Orange glowing steel sitting on paper, and the paper's not burning. So it can't be hot. All this water, you're putting on stuff to keep down the fuming. The guys go down into the basement. Pictures that were taken on the 17th of September, down in the basement. It was like it was as hot as an oven. They'd be cooked. So you see them down there walking around, wading through a puddle of water. Then we have toasted cars, vehicles, 1,400 vehicles sprinkled all over southern Manhattan, some as much as a half mile or more away, that were seen going into spontaneous combustion. Just for no apparent reason, the sea of paper in between the towers and where these cars went into spontaneous combustion. Some cars were flipped and some were toasted. What I mean by toasted as it's history, it's toast. I don't know what happened to it. Something made it so that you can't get it fixed. You just have to go get a new one and start over. It's beyond repair. And what is really strange is in front of a toasted car is a not toasted car, but it's upside down. It's parked in the right place, but the tires are going up, not down. So you either get toasted or flipped cars. Leaves on the trees that didn't get ripped off. We have, low seismic signal. We have, gelification of material. Remember that big horseshoe beam we saw pictures of?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't have any cracks in it. It's bent more than 180 degrees. Load doesn't do that. Explain the, loading situation that we caused that. So we have this strange bending of metals. And we have the peeling effect, like some of the toasted cars, it looked like half the thickness of their split thickness of their doors was peeled out. Not burned, just separated, like it's delaminated, but it's not a laminated door. A fusion of dissimilar materials. You know, you hear about the meteorite, it has all sorts of stuff in it, including paper that didn't burn. So it didn't melt together. Something else causes stuff to fuse together. Circular holes in material. There's two different kinds. There's the, post-hole digger type appearance, where, like, the middle of Building 6 was cored out with these cylindrical cutouts. Then there's the circular holes in windows. Totally different cause, I think. But they're rounded holes in the outer pane of a double-paned window, where the inner pane is still intact. Let me say that again. The inner pane is intact, but only the outer pane has a hole in it and not a crack. You throw a baseball through a window, you get a spider web pattern. You don't get a round hole. I don't think a professional glass cutter could do that either. Melting without heat, metal luminance without heat. Remember, hot things glow, but not everything that glows is hot. There's also bombs go boom, but not everything that goes boom is a bomb. Think of an egg in your microwave oven. What about popcorn? But an egg in your microwave would make a boom sound. And there's evidence at the WTC at ground level of Scott packs exploding. These are the oxygen tanks or the air tanks that the firefighters wear when they fight fires so they can breathe, good air. They're on vehicles, on the fire trucks. They were exploding. Some vehicles just suddenly exploded. The super fine dust that was so fine it went up in, who knows how far up, upper atmosphere, I don't know, but way up. It was so much dust that went up. My detractors like to say, oh, she's silly for thinking the dust went up. Why was it a total blackout? The dust wasn't in the air. The dust was blocking out 100% of the sunlight. And actually, there was a fellow who, I think it's an EMT worker, who dove under an emergency vehicle when one of the towers was coming apart. And he thought he was buried because it was a total blackout. But then the dust cleared and the sunshine came in. And wait, the vehicle he dove under wasn't there anymore. He doesn't remember it rolling off of him or, you know, he doesn't know what happened to it. But during this blackout, there's also other strange things. That's when the spontaneous combustion seemed to occur. There's a first responder who said it was, you know, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was so total blackout. But thank goodness the car started lighting up because then I could see where I was going. And one emergency worker had her coat lighting up, her emergency coat, and it's like a human flashlight.
Great.
Somebody else had their shoelaces catch fire.
Let's stop right there. We're going to break. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we're back from break. Ralph Winterbrook Show. We have Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson out of the UK, and we're getting a list of all of the real empirical evidence from Dr. Judy Wood. Let's take two callers here quickly, and then we're going to continue on with more evidence. Tom, in Ohio, you have a question for one of the guests or both?
Yes, I do. Just quickly, I guess you could call me skeptical, but I'm willing to entertain that notion. I guess if Judy can answer a couple of quick questions. I've heard her referred to as rather than Judy, but Judas Wood. And I'm
It's Dr. Judy Wood.
Dr. Judy, okay. Does she have any relatives in Israel living there? And I'd like to know whether or not she is a Zionist.
I'm a forensic scientist, and I study the evidence of what happened, the scientific forensic evidence.
Can you comment on Israel's involvement in this?
You have to first determine what happened before you can determine who did it.
We haven't ever got to that. These are all point questions because we haven't ever got to the whodunit part. We're into the how and what happened. But thanks for calling, Tom. Craig in Ontario, you got a question for either one of the guests?
Yes, I do. Hey, Dr. Wood. Quick question. I understand everything you're saying. Mine has to do with the measurement of the seismic footprint as the towers fell. My question is, who takes those measurements? Why were they taken? And how come the powers that be haven't censored those? If I just understand how they were taken and who measured them.
You're talking about the seismic signals?
Yes.
I didn't quite hear you well. There's quite a few seismic stations. They're all over the country. You can go to the USGS.gov on the Internet and find an amazing number of seismic stations all over the place. And so what you can find that was like when Building 7 went away, you could find seismic signals for a quarry blast in over New Jersey or Pennsylvania or somewhere because the seismic stations over there recorded a stronger signal than elsewhere. They did not, as well as the one in Connecticut, didn't record anything of a seismic signal that corresponded to when Building 7 went away, that stood out of background noise. The Palisades recorded something, if you really look carefully and check, it was not of the magnitude that it should have been. It was just barely detectable.
Right. So on your website, you list where these measurements were taken and from what seismic stations?
I do in my book. The website is just a filing cabinet. It was my life insurance policy while working on the book. Because,
right.
You know, dead people keep secrets, and I didn't want to be one of those. So I had that out there to keep me safe while working on the book.
Right, because, I mean, it totally makes sense what you're saying. It was some kind of a directed weapon because all of the dust that came out of that, just impossible for me. I'm sure sheer mass of it falling down.
And the building wasn't left. The building's gone. You know, that afternoon, there's a picture of an ambulance parked in front of Tower 1, what used to be Tower 1. There's no Tower 1 there, down to ground level. But the ambulance is still there, intact.
Yeah,
and you can see Building 7 in the background, so you know what day it is.
Okay. All right, thanks for answering the question.
Sure. You might want to check my book, Chapter 6. There's shows some seismic history, and also, there was an earthquake in Manhattan January of that year. It was a 2.4, and it's a huge signal, but comparison.
Yeah, you've got how many seismic recordings do you have? I'm looking, what was it, about five or six of them here, it looks like, or something like that.
There's like, I think five of them for Building 7.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other ones. I did different ways of looking at the data, and I actually plotted the data points myself.
Mm-hmm.
for the tower's demise, because I was trying to determine myself, you know, see it for myself, not what people tell me, how long it appeared to me that the ground shook.
Mm-hmm.
And for the North Tower, it appeared the ground shook for only 8 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But it would take 9.5 seconds to drop a bowling ball off the roof and have it hit the pavement below.
Mm-hmm.
So what that tells you is the building could not have fallen.
So, okay, let's take one more caller, and then we'll get on to the finish up the rest of your evidence. Leo in Massachusetts, you got a question for either one of the guests?
Hello?
Are you there, Leo?
Yeah, hi, hi.
Hey.
Dr. Wood, thank you for showing up on this. My real problem is that we're having a hard enough time with all the probabilities of thermite used in the demolition, that I'm beginning to think that the scalar aspect is possibly the trigger mechanisms for the multiple bombs.
As I show in my evidence, that there's no seismic signal that corresponds to two 110-story buildings weighing 500,000 tons each slamming to the ground. The buildings did not slam to the ground. If you're using bombs, the ground shakes when a bomb goes off. And it, you know, chunks go flying. Those chunks land on the ground, and you get a thud. You know, you get this enormous amount of material landing on the ground within a few seconds. You know, within 1 minute, within 60 seconds, you would have a lot of that stuff slamming to the ground. Didn't happen. The towers turned to dust. That's the only explanation for a lack of seismic signal at all of the seismic recording stations. Appropriate.
Well, my question is, since the thermite has pretty much been proven, especially the 45-degree cut on the one of the main girders.
It hasn't been proven.
Hang on. It's been proven for what? What is the thermite
that,
have done?
That it had to have been a thermite-based destruction to give that nice...
The building turned to dust. How does thermite address the evidence? You have to start with the evidence. You don't start with a theory and then cherry pick. So we have evidence that shows that the buildings turn into dust in midair. Thermite heats things. Do you know people who are blinded by the light from, you know, the whole tower is being like 3,000 degrees? Also, thermite works on the surface, and you need thermal conductivity to get into, you know, affecting the entire, like, 2 or 3 or 4 inch thickness. It's a welding material. You've been hoodwinked.
Well,
thermite is a welding material.
How did the girder get cut at a nice clean 45 degree angle? That doesn't seem scientifically possible.
During cleanup, I don't know, but
you know the picture of what I
girder,
speak, right?
Hang on. Is cutting a column at 45 degrees cause a building to turn into powder in midair?
I'm saying it could be a combination of a bunch of things.
The building turned into powder in midair. That column is down in the basement of one of the towers, the Tower 1, actually. And it was made, I actually know who made the cut, but it was made with an oxytorch. But still, even if somebody had cut one column of the building, it's got, 47 core columns and... Was it 236 perimeter columns throughout the whole building? Cut one column. How's it going to turn the building into powder?
No, I'm not saying that your thesis is incorrect. I'm saying that there are possibly two different...
There's no thesis here. We're talking about evidence.
May I just also add a couple of points to this? Because this picture always comes up, and as Dr. Wood has said, it doesn't explain what happened to the building. Now, if you want to talk about that column being cut with a charge and an oxyacetylene torch, you might as well just discuss, you know, another building somewhere else in the world being mysteriously destroyed. It has no bearing on the totality of what happened to those buildings. And if you read on from this point in the discussion, you will discover the secret of what destroyed those buildings. And it's that which the thermite was put out there for, to keep that covered up, because the secret, which was in plain sight, will change the world, and it will change the way everyone looks at the world once they understand the evidence that Dr. Wood has been talking about.
The molten pool that was recognized, what is your analysis of the molten pool?
There wasn't a molten pool. It wasn't there. We've talked about that already. How can there have been a molten pool?
Yeah, there's a water main that was broken with firefighters wading in knee-deep water. The water wasn't hot because they didn't look like boiled chicken. It was water that was knee-deep.
And there's another picture. Is it the Frank Fascino picture, which is always reported on? The one with the fireman standing in the hole.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Standing in the hole. And the fireman looking down into the hole, and this is claimed to be molten metal. And yet, if you see the video of that, there is a video of that available, you can see the guys moving flashlights around. And yet, they've selectively chosen this picture as showing molten metal. That's not what it was. It was some flashlights that they were using to peer down into a hole, to dig something out. I'm not sure what it was. So when you study the evidence for this molten metal, you find that it doesn't stack up. And we keep going round in these circles on these radio programs because this, as I said earlier on in the program, this disinformation was put out 5 years ago and it is continually recycled and slightly adjusted. And here we are. We're not seeing, for example, one of the other pieces of evidence that Dr. Wood was going to go on to before we took the choice to answer these calls, and that's the Great Big Hurricane, parked off the coast of New York, traveled in a straight line for 4 days. How can it have done that and then made a right-hand turn the next day? That is of enormously huge significance. And yet here we are talking about an angle-cut column. It's just ridiculous. And that's what this is all for. And if you study the available evidence on Dr. Wood's website, in the book, in my book, which is free, you will find all of this out.
Well, thanks for calling, Leo. We appreciate your questions here. We don't have a lot of time. We've addressed those. Let's go ahead, Dr. Wood, with more of the empirical evidence that we can prove.
Great. Yeah. All of the stuff I've mentioned, it's not a thesis. It's not a speculation. It's not opinion. It's physical evidence, factual evidence. It's evidence that whatever story you come up with needs to deal with, like toasted cars, weird fires, dustified building, and so forth. And something else that needs to be considered too. The North Tower got a hole. They said, a plane-shaped hole at 8:45 approximately. Then the South Tower got a hole. Then the South Tower turned into dust. Then the North Tower turned into dust. Then Building 7 turned into dust. That was 5 events. What a coincidence. What probability do you have that precisely at each of those time of each of those events, the Earth's magnetic field shifted, abruptly shifted? You can, it's within as close as you can get within seconds, within a fraction of a second, with the North Tower, when the plane-shaped hole appeared. The magnetic field was wandering down, and then it abruptly started going up.
And that's in Alaska, right?
Yep. That was the seismic, magnetometers recording at 6 different stations in Alaska. And then when the South Tower got its hole, it quit drifting up and started drifting horizontally. It was almost like one undid the other. But then when the towers when the South Tower turned to dust, it abruptly started going down. And then when the North Tower turned to dust, it really went down. It was haywire all afternoon until, amazingly enough, Building 7 turned into dust. Then it was almost back to normal again. It just kind of like that undid the others or something. It's just something that needs to be addressed. Also, what needs to be addressed is for 4 days prior to 9/11, pretending that 9/11, you don't know anything's going to happen. You have this hurricane, Category 3 hurricane, aimed right directly towards New York City, 4 days straight. And people don't hear about it. It wasn't not reported. It was very underreported. 10 to 15 minutes before the North Tower got its hole, I have recordings or pictures of what was on the TV weather news that morning. on page 400 of the book. There's that patch of the ocean where the hurricane was. It doesn't show up on any of them. NBC, CBS, ABC, or Fox. And then on the other side, on page 401, I have the hurricane superimposed by matching the coastline as to where it would be, along with the satellite images of it. Why, you know, didn't you warn people and give them voluntary evacuation time? You know, usually they give you voluntary evacuation before it's mandatory, just in case the hurricane doesn't turn around when they think it's going to turn around. And it didn't. They kept saying it was going to turn around for 4 days. But it pulled up to New York City, 8 a.m. that morning, turned around. It's like it pulled up to a chalk line, turned around and started heading out of town that afternoon. But for about 24 hours, the pressure stayed constant, the wind speed stayed constant, and the location stayed constant. Where in the center of that 24 hours was the events of 9/11. Also, there was a high pressure system moving from the west that met with the hurricane. And lo and behold, when did they meet? 10 a.m. on 9/11. You see the pressure going up, and then it starts going down. So the high pressure system was moving in, then the hurricane, you know, it started turning it the other way around. So those things need to be addressed as well. Also, there's partially dissolved steel. How did that happen? How do you get dissolved steel from a mechanical failure? Bombs will blow stuff apart, rip stuff apart. They don't dissolve things. This is like rapid aging, as though something's been at the bottom of the ocean for 100 years. And there's some of the samples of steel look like they were, you know, dipped in acid or something, just eaten out, dissolved. And with the fire hoses on them, it's kind of like rivers of dust, steel dust, just rolled off of them. I think we've all seen many of the 9/11 people have seen the Appendix C from the FEMA report, saying it's the greatest mystery. Why the steel looks like that. I call it a tortilla chip. It's ultra thin. Also, you know, the glowing stuff on the street. So there's a whole lot of anomalies that need to be addressed. And thermite addresses none of them. Actually, the evidence contradicts thermite.
What's the one phenomenon that you've experienced that would account for all this?
One phenomena?
Yeah, the Hutchison effect.
Explanation.
Oh, yeah. The explanation. After I tallied up all the different effects I'd seen, I just happened upon this blog of someone, and it looked like they reproduced every single one of them. I checked. Every single one of the phenomena I showed that I talked about was there. And that was the blog of John Hutchison. He has replicated the work of Nikola Tesla and then some. You can go to his lab and see him demonstrate it. So I did. You know, Tesla doesn't live in the here and now. John Hutchison does. And actually, he is a national treasure, you could say. Here's somebody who can reproduce this for good purposes. He does it on a small scale, but this is free energy technology that could be used for good, that could be used to help the world.
Okay, well, we've got to go to break and come back, and then we'll let you close out here with Hutchison effect and whatever else you want to talk about. Back in a minute. Okay, well, we're back for a break here, and Dr. Judy Wood and Andrew Johnson from the UK. Go ahead, Dr. Wood.
Well, I only could talk briefly about the Hutchison effect and Tesla's work and his work of many others. T. Townsend Brown also is a fellow, Ed Leedskalnin, who built Coral Castle in Florida, which all evidence is that he was levitating rocks and cutting rocks, putting them into place, very much on the same scale as the Great Pyramids, the size of the rocks, that this 100-pound guy was moving around. So this is an amazing technology. Just think for a minute, instead of arguing about who's right, who's wrong, just entertain the idea for a moment. Assume this is true. This technology exists. And by all evidence, man has in his hands the method of disrupting the molecular basis for matter. But this can also be used for good and provide free energy to the world. This ignoring it does not keep this from happening again, the use of this. We can use it for good, but it's the responsibility of all humans on this planet to be sure we don't destroy the planet and use, you know, take responsibility for how this technology is used. And I think that's what I'd like people to really think about. Just, you know, consider, if this is true, what are the ramifications? And just how much effort would be used in trying to cover it up?
Why don't you tell people where to get your book? And then, Andrew, if you want to make some comments, too, here.
WhereDidTheTowersGo.com. No spaces in there, just all the words together. It's hard to type. WhereDidTheTowersGo.com is where to buy the book. Or through my website, which is DrJudyWood.com. That's Dr. Judy Wood, 2 4-letter words, DrJudyWood.com. And if you want a sampling of all of the evidence, go to DrJudyWood.com/WTC, which is the Cliff Notes page.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add that, going back to the Hutchison effect, John Hutchison did actually submit an affidavit for Dr. Wood's court case, which essentially means that he was willing to, you know, put himself up for cross-examination in a court. So anybody who is a fraud is very unlikely to make that sort of voluntary motion, if you will. And also the key to this is the energy question. We talked about this a little bit before, but the whole sort of first sort of three-quarters of the program, almost two-thirds perhaps of today's program, we've talked about all the thermite stuff and the hearings, and that's all basically been set up to reduce the amount of time we can spend on talking about the actual evidence and what it means. And I would say that in looking at this whole thing, Dr. Wood has reverse engineered the events of 9/11, certainly as to what happened at the World Trade Center. And if you read my book, which is 9/11 Finding the Truth, available free from checktheevidence.com, I regard that as some kind of reverse engineering of the cover-up. So if you read those two books together, I think that will give you a very good understanding of how this is playing out, and particularly going back to what Dr. Wood was saying about the using the technology wisely and this sort of thing. I've written an article called A World of Abundance or A World of Scarcity, A Call to Awareness, A Time to Choose, and you can read and consider the topics raised in that article.
I would like to say that on 9/11, Andrew's committed to be there, and Dr. Judy Wood, if she's available. And it's going to be the anniversary of 9/11, and it's going to be a show about the evidence. None of this damn nonsense. We're going to cover all the evidence that's there for real.
Great.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else got any comment here? We're getting close to the end here.
Okay. Well, just repeat the websites again. Checktheevidence.com, DrJudyWood.com. The information is there. It's available for anyone that wants to discover it. You know, it's all there for you now, and you've just got to take the time and work your way through it. Ask us questions. We'll try and answer them as best we can.
I don't ask anyone to believe me. I want you to believe in yourself and see what you see in the evidence. I just provide the evidence to lead you through.
Well, thank you, Dr. Judy Wood, and thank you, Andrew, to UK. I know it's late there. Getting